with its window box flowers and brightly painted houses, then turned onto Periwinkle Street, where the pavement gave way to mud and the houses to shabby, sagging flats. Men with hats pulled low over their eyes were congregating around the end of a seedy cul-de-sac. They appeared to be guarding the door to a house with its windows blacked out. Sharon told us to stay put, and we waited while he went to talk with them. The air smelled faintly of gasoline. In the distance, loud, laughing voices swelled and fell away, swelled and fell away. It was the sound of men in a sports bar watching a game. Only it couldn't have been. That was strictly a modern sound, and there were no televisions here. A man in mud-splashed pants came out of the house. As the door swung open, the voices grew louder, and then faded when it slammed shut. He walked across the street carrying a bucket. We turned, watching as he walked towards something I hadn't noticed, a pair of bear cubs chained to a sawed-off lamppost at the edge of the street. They were terribly sad-looking, with only a few feet of slack on their chains, and they sat on the muddy ground watching the man approach with something like dread, their furry ears flattened back. The man dumped some putrid table scraps before them and left without a word. The whole scene made me unutterably depressed.
"Those there are training grims,"
Sharon said, and we turned to find him standing behind us.
"Blood sport is big business here, and fighting a grim bear is considered the ultimate challenge. Young fighters have to train somehow, so they start out fighting the cubs."
"That's awful," I said.
"The bears have the day off, though, thanks to your beastie."
Sharon pointed at the little house.
"He's in there, out through the back. But before we go in, I should warn you. This is an ambrosia den, and there'll be peculiars in there who are lit out of their minds. Don't talk to them, and whatever you do, don't look them in the eye. I know people who've been blinded that way."
"What do you mean, blinded?" I said.
"Just what it sounds like. Now follow me and don't ask any more questions. Slaves don't question their masters."
I saw Emma grit her teeth. We fell in behind Sharon as he crossed to the men clustered around the door of the house. Sharon talked with the men. I struggled to overhear while maintaining a slave-like distance and averting my eyes. One of them told Sharon there was an admission fee, and he dug a coin from his cloak and paid it. Another asked about us.
"I haven't given them names yet," Sharon said. "Just got them yesterday. They're still so green I don't dare let them out of my sight."
"Is that right?" the man said, approaching us. "Don't have names?"
I shook my head no, playing mute along with Emma. The man looked us up and down. I wanted to squirm out of my skin.
"Haven't I seen you somewhere?" he said, leaning closer.
I said nothing.
"Maybe in the window at Lorraine's,"
Sharon offered.
"Nah,"
the man said, then waved his hand.
"Ah, I'm sure it'll come to me."
I only risked a direct look at him once he'd turned away. If he was a ditch pirate, he wasn't one of those we'd tangled with. He had a bandage over his chin and another over his forehead. Several of the other men were similarly bandaged, and one sported an eye patch. I wondered if they'd been injured fighting Grimms. The man with the eye patch opened the door for us.
"Enjoy yourselves," he said. "But I wouldn't send them into the cage today, unless you're ready to scrape them off the ground." "We're just here to watch and learn," said Sharon. "Smart man."
We were waved in and hurried close at Sharon's heels, anxious to escape the door lurker's stares. 7-foot Sharon had to duck to pass through the doorway, and he stayed ducked the entire time we were inside, so low were the ceilings. The room we entered was dark and reeked of smoke, and until my eyes adjusted, all I could see were pinpricks of orange light glowing here and there. Slowly, the room came into view, lit by oil lamps trimmed so low they gave no more light than matches. It was long and narrow, with bunk beds built into the walls like you might find in the lightless bowels of an ocean-going ship. I tripped over something and nearly lost my balance. "Why is it so dark in here?" I muttered, already breaking my promise not to ask questions.
"The eyes get sensitive as the effects of Ambro wear off," Sharon explained. "Even weak daylight is nearly unbearable."
That's when I noticed the people in the bunks, some sprawled and sleeping, others sitting up in nests of rumpled sheets. They watched us, smoking listlessly and speaking in murmurs. A few talked to themselves, reeling out incomprehensible monologues. Several had bandaged faces, like the doorman, or wore masks. I wanted to ask about the masks, but I wanted to get that hollow and get out of there even more. We pushed through a curtain of hanging beads and entered a room that was somewhat brighter and considerably more crowded than the first. A burly man stood on a chair at the opposite wall, directing people to one of two doors.
"Fighters to the left, spectators to the right," he shouted. "Place your bets in the parlor."
I could hear voices yelling a few rooms away, and a moment later, the crowd parted to allow 3 men to pass, 2 of whom were dragging the 3rd, who was unconscious and bleeding. Whistles and catcalls followed them.
"That's what losers look like," the man on the chair bellowed. "And that," he said, pointing into a side room, "is what cowards look like."
I peeked into the room, where 2 men under guard stood miserably for all to see. They were covered in tar and feathers.
"Let them be a reminder," said the man. "All fighters must spend 2 minutes in the cage, minimum."
"So which are you?" Sharon asked me. "A fighter or a spectator?"
I felt my chest tighten as I tried to imagine what was about to happen. I wasn't just going to tame this hollow, but do it in front of a rowdy and potentially hostile audience, and then try and get out. I found myself hoping that it wasn't too injured, because I had a feeling I'd need its strength to clear us an exit. These peculiars weren't going to give up their new toy without a fight. "A fighter," I said. "To really control it, I'm going to have to get close." Emma met my eyes and smiled. "You can do this," her smile said, and I knew, in that moment, that I could. I strode through the door meant for fighters, buoyed with new confidence, Sharon and Emma following behind me. That confidence lasted approximately 4 seconds, which was the length of time it took me to walk into the room and notice the blood that was puddled and smeared all over the floors and walls. A river of it led down a light-filled hall and out an open door, through which I could see another crowd and, just beyond them, the bars of a large cage. A shrill call came from outside. The next combatant was being summoned. A man emerged from a darkened room to our right. He was stripped to the waist and wore a plain white mask. He stood at the top of the hall for a moment as if gathering his courage. Then he tipped back his head and raised his hand above it. In his hand, he held a small glass vial.
"Don't look," Sharon said,
backing us against a wall, but I couldn't help myself. Slowly, the man poured black liquid from the vial into each of his mask's eye holes. Then he dropped the empty vial, lowered his head, and began to groan. For a few seconds he seemed paralyzed, but then his body shuddered, and two cones of white light shot from the eye holes of his mask. Even in the bright room, they were distinct. Emma gasped. The man, who had thought he was alone, turned toward us in surprise. His eye beams arced over our heads, and the wall above us sizzled.
"Just passing through," Sharon said, the tone of which managed to say, "Howdy, friend," and "Please don't kill us with those things," at the same time.
"Pass through, then," the man snarled.
By then his eye beams were starting to fade, and just as he turned away, they flickered and winked out. He walked down the hall and went out the door, leaving two wisps of smoke curling in his wake. When he'd gone, I ventured a look at the wallpaper above our heads. A pair of caramel singe marks traced the path his eyes had made across the wall. Thank God he hadn't looked me in the eye.
"Before we go a step farther," I said to Sharon, "I think you'd better explain."
"Ambrosia," Sharon said. "Fighters take it to give themselves enhanced abilities. Trouble is, it doesn't last long, and when it wears off, you're left weaker than before. If you make a habit of it, your ability wears down to almost nothing, until you take more Ambro. Pretty soon you're taking it not just to fight, but to function as a peculiar. You become dependent on whoever's selling it."
He nodded to the room on our right, where murmuring voices created an odd counterpoint to the full-throated shouts outside.
"It was the greatest trick the whites ever pulled, making that stuff. No one here will ever betray them, so long as they're addicted to ambrosia."
I peeked into the side room to see what a peculiar drug dealer looked like, and I caught a glimpse of someone in a bizarre bearded mask flanked by two men holding guns.
"What's happened with that man's eyes?" Emma asked.
"The burst of light is a side effect," Sharon said. "Another is that, over a period of years, the ambro melts your face. That's how you know the hardcore users. They wear masks to hide the damage."
As Emma and I shared a look of disgust, a voice inside the room summoned us.
"Hello out there," the dealer called. "Come in here, please."
"Sorry," I said. "We have to go."
Sharon poked my shoulder and hissed,
"You're a slave, remember?"
Yes, sir," I said, and went as far as the door.
The masked man was sitting in a little chair in a room with frescoed walls. He held himself with unsettling stillness, one arm resting on a side table and his legs crossed delicately at the knee. His gunman occupied two corners of the room, and in another stood a wooden chest on wheels.
"Don't be afraid," the dealer said, beckoning me in. "Your friends can come too."
I took another few steps into the room, Sharon and Emma just behind me.
"I haven't seen you around before," the dealer said.
"I just bought him," Sharon said. "He doesn't even have a..."
"Was I speaking to you?"
the dealer said sharply. Sharon went quiet.
"No, I wasn't,"
the dealer said. He stroked his fake beard and seemed to study me through the hollowed eyes of his mask. I wondered what he looked like underneath, and just how much ambrosia you'd have to pour into your face before you melted it. Then I shuddered and wished I hadn't.
"You're here to fight," he said.
I told him that I was.
"Well, you're in luck.
I just got a prime batch of Ambrose, so your chances of survival have shot up dramatically. I don't need any, thank you. He looked at his gunmen for a reaction. They remained stone-faced, and then he laughed.
That's a hollow ghast out there, you know. You've heard of them?
They were all I could think about, especially the one outside. I was desperate to be on my way, but this creepy guy clearly ran the place, and making him angry was more trouble than we needed.
I've heard of them, I said.
And how do you think you'll do against one?
I think I'll do okay.
Just okay?
The man crossed his arms.
What I want to know is, should I put money on you? Are you going to win?
I told him what he wanted to hear.
Yes.
Well, if I'm going to put money on you, you're going to need some help.
He stood up, went to the medicine cabinet, and opened its doors. The interior glittered with glass vials, rows of them, all brimming with dark liquid, the tops plugged with tiny corks. He plucked one out and brought it to me.
Take this, he said, holding out the vial. It takes all your best attributes and magnifies them times 10.
No, thank you, I said. I don't need it.
That's what they all say at first. Then, after they get beaten, if they survive, everyone takes it.
He turned the vial in his hand and held it to the weak light. The ambrosia inside swam with sparkling, silvery particles. I stared, despite myself.
What's it made of? I asked.
He laughed.
Snips and snails and puppy dog's tails.
He held it toward me again.
No charge, he said.
He said he doesn't want any,
Sharon said sharply. I thought the dealer would lash out at him, but instead he cocked his head at Sharon and said,
Don't I know you?
I don't think so,
Sharon said.
Sure I do, the dealer said, nodding. You were one of my best customers. What happened to you?
I kicked the habit.
The dealer stepped toward him.
Looks like you waited too long, he said,
and pulled teasingly on Sharon's hood. Sharon snatched the dealer's hand. The guards raised their guns.
Careful,
the dealer said. Sharon held him a moment longer, then let go.
Now, the dealer said, turning toward me, you're not going to refuse a free sample, are you?
I had no intention of ever uncorking the stuff, but it seemed like the best way to end this was to take it, so I did.
Good boy,
the dealer said, and he shooed us from the room.
You were an addict?
Emma hissed at Sharon.
Why didn't you tell us?
What difference would it have made?
Sharon said.
Yes, I had some bad years. Then Bentham took me in and weaned me off the stuff.
I turned to look at him, trying to imagine. Bentham did?
Like I said, I owe the man my life.
Emma took the vial and held it up. In the stronger light, the silvery bits inside the black liquid shone like tiny flakes of sun. It was mesmerizing, and despite the side effects, I couldn't help but wonder how a few drops might enhance my abilities.
He wouldn't say what was in it,
Emma said.
We are, Sharon said, little bits of our stolen souls, crushed up and fed back to us by the whites. A piece of every peculiar they kidnap winds up in a vial like that one.
Emma thrust the vial away in horror, and Sharon took it and tucked it into his cloak.
Never know when one of these might come in handy,
he said.
Knowing what it's made of, I said, I can't believe you'd ever take that stuff.
I never said I was proud of myself, Sharon said.
The whole diabolical scheme was perfect in its evilness. The whites had turned the peculiars of Devil's Acre into cannibals, hungry for their own souls. Addicting them to ambrosia ensured their control and kept the population in check. If we didn't free them soon, our friends' souls would be the next to fill those vials. I heard the hollow roar. It sounded like a cry of victory, and the man we'd watched take Ambro a minute earlier was dragged through the door and past us down the hall, bleeding and unconscious.
My turn, I thought,
and a thrill of adrenaline shot through me. Out back of the Ambro den was a walled courtyard, the centerpiece of which was a free-standing cage about 40 feet square, its sturdy bars easily capable, it seemed to me, of containing a hologast. A line had been painted in the dirt approximately as far from the cage bars as a hollow's tongues could reach, and the crowd, made up of 40 or so rough-looking peculiars, had wisely planted themselves behind it. The courtyard's walls were ringed with smaller cages, and inside, a tiger, a wolf, and what looked like a full-grown grim bear, animals of lesser interest, at least compared to a hologast, were being held to fight another day. The main attraction could be seen pacing inside the big cage, tethered to a heavy iron post by a chain around its neck. It was in such a sorry state that I was tempted to feel bad for it. The hologast had been splashed with white paint and daubed here and there with mud, which made it visible to everyone, but also a bit ridiculous-looking, like a Dalmatian or a mime. It was limping badly and leaving trails of black blood, and its muscular tongues, which in anticipation of a fight would normally have been whipping around in the air, were dragging limply behind it. Hurt and humiliated, it was far from the nightmare vision I had become accustomed to, but the crowd, having never seen a hollow, seemed impressed nevertheless. Which was just as well. Even in this much reduced state, the hollow had managed to knock out several fighters in a row. It was still plenty dangerous and very unpredictable. Which is why, I assumed, men armed with rifles were stationed around the courtyard. Better safe than sorry. I huddled with Sharon and Emma to strategize. The problem, we agreed, wasn't getting me into the cage with the hollow. It wasn't even controlling the hollow. We were working under the assumption that I could do it. The problem would be getting the hollow out and away from these people.
Think you could melt through that chain around its neck? I asked Emma.
If I had 2 days to do it, she said. I don't suppose we could just explain to everyone that we really need the hollow and we'll bring it back when we're finished.
You wouldn't even get that whole sentence out, said Sharon, eyeing the rowdy crowd. This is more fun than these blighters have had in years. No chance.
Next fighter!
Shouted a woman standing watch from a second-story window. Away from the crowd, a small clutch of men argued about which of them would fight next. There was already plenty of blood soaking the ground inside the cage, and none seemed in a hurry to contribute more. They'd been drawing straws, and a well-built man who was stripped to the waist had just picked the short one.
No mask, Sharon said, noting the man's bushy mustache and relatively unscarred face. He must be just starting out.
The man gathered his courage and strutted toward the crowd. In a loud, Spanish-accented voice, he told them he'd never been beaten in a fight, that he was going to kill the hollow and keep its head for a trophy, and that his peculiar ability, ultra-quick healing, would make it impossible for the Hollow to inflict a mortal wound.
"See these beauty marks?"
he said, turning to show off a collection of nasty, claw-shaped scars on his back.
"A Grim gave them to me last week. They were an inch deep," he claimed, "and healed the same day."
He pointed at the Hollow in the cage.
"That wrinkled old thing doesn't stand a chance."
"Now it's definitely going to kill him," Emma said.
The man poured a vial of Ambro into his eyes. His body stiffened, and light beams shot from his pupils, leaving a cataract of burn marks on the ground. A moment later, they winked out. Thus fortified, he strode confidently to the cage door, where a man with a large key ring met him to unlock it.
"Keep an eye on the guy with the keys," I said. "We might need those."
Sharon reached into his pocket and drew out a wriggling rat by its tail.
"Did you hear that, Xavier?"
he said to the rat.
"Go get the keys."
He dropped the rodent on the ground, and it scurried away. The boastful fighter entered the cage and began to face off with the Hollow. He'd taken a small knife from his belt and assumed a bent-kneed stance, but other than that, he showed little appetite for a fight. Instead, he seemed to be running out the clock by running his mouth, giving a speech with all the blowhard bluster of a professional wrestler.
"Come at me, you animal! I am not afraid! I'll slice out your tongues and make a belt to hold up my pants! I'll pick my teeth with your toenails and mount your head on my wall!"
The Hollow watched him boredly. The fighter made a show of drawing his knife across his forearm, and as blood began to well, he held up the wound. It healed and closed before a single drop could reach the ground.
"I am invincible!"
he cried.
"I am not afraid!"
Suddenly, the Hollow faked toward the man and roared, which so startled him that he dropped his knife and threw his arms across his face. It seemed the Hollow had grown tired of him. The crowd burst into riotous laughter, and so did we, and the man, red-faced with embarrassment, bent to pick up his knife. Now the Hollow was moving toward him, chains clinking as it went, tongues extended and curled like clenched fists. The man realized he'd have to engage the monster if he was to salvage his dignity, so he took a few tentative steps forward while brandishing the knife. The Hollow flicked one of its painted tongues at him. The man swiped at it with his knife, and connected. Cut! The Hollow squealed and retracted the tongue, then hissed at the man like an angry cat.
"That'll teach you to attack Don Fernando!" the man shouted.
"This guy never learns," I said. "Taunting Hollows is a bad idea."
He seemed to have the Hollow on the run. It backed away while the man approached, still hissing and waving his knife. When the Hollow could retreat no farther, its back against the bars of the cage, the man raised his knife.
"Prepare to die, demon spawn!"
he shouted, and charged. For a moment, I wondered if I'd have to step in and save the Hollow, but soon it became clear that it had set a trap. Snaking beneath the man was all the slack of the Hollow's chain, which the Hollow grabbed and swept violently to one side, sending Don Fernando flying head first into a metal post. Clonk! And he was out, limp on the ground. Another K.O. He'd been such a shameless braggart that the crowd couldn't help cheering. A team of men with torches and electric-tipped taser poles ran into the cage and kept the Hollow at bay while the unconscious fighter was dragged out.
"Who's next?"
the referee woman shouted. The remaining fighters traded looks of apprehension, then resumed arguing. Now no one wanted to enter the cage, except me. The man's ridiculous performance and the Hollow's trick had given me an idea. It wasn't a surefire plan, or even a good one, but it was something, and that was better than nothing. We, meaning the Hollow and I, were going to fake its death. I screwed up my courage, and, as tends to happen while I'm doing something either slightly brave or very foolish, my brain disengaged from my body. I seemed to watch myself from afar as I waved an arm at the referee and shouted, "I'll go next!" Before then, I'd been invisible. Now the crowd and the fighters all turned to stare.
"What's your plan?"
Emma whispered to me. I had one, but had been so caught up with working it out that I'd failed to share it with Emma or Sharon, and now I had no time to lay it out for them, which was probably for the best. If spoken aloud, I feared it might sound ridiculous or, worse yet, impossible, and then I'd lose my nerve. "I think it's better if I just show you," I said. "But it definitely won't work unless we get those keys."
"Don't worry. Xavier's on the job," said Sharon.
We heard a squeak and looked down to see the rat in question with a piece of cheese in its mouth. Sharon picked him up and scolded him.
"Keys, I said, not cheese!"
"I'll get them," Emma assured me. "Just promise you'll come back in one piece."
I promised. She wished me luck and kissed me on the lips. Then I looked at Sharon, who tilted his head at me as if to say,
"I hope you're not expecting a kiss from me, too."
And I just laughed and walked toward the fighters. They were looking me up and down. I was sure they thought I was crazy, and yet none of them tried to stop me. After all, if this ill-prepared kid, who wasn't even going to take a vial of Ambro before his fight, wanted to throw himself at the beast and wear it down a little, that was a gift they were willing to accept. And if I died trying, I was just a slave anyway. Which made me hate them, and put me in mind of the poor kidnapped peculiars, whose extracted souls were swimming around in the vials they all clutched. Which made me even angrier. I did my best to channel all that rage into unwavering determination and focus, but it was mostly just distracting. And yet, while the man with the keys was working to open the cage, I looked inward and found, to my surprise and delight, that I was not racked with doubt, nor haunted by visions of my impending death, nor battling waves of terror. I had met and exerted control over this Hollow twice before. This would be the third time. Despite my anger, I was calm and quiet, and within this quiet, I found that the words I needed were waiting for me, ready to be spoken. The man opened the door and I stepped into the cage. He'd only just closed it when the Hollow started toward me, rattling its chain like an angry ghost.
"Tongue, don't fail me now."
I raised a hand to hide my mouth and said, in guttural Hollow,
"Stop!"
The Hollow stopped.
"Sit!"
I said. It sat. A wave of relief washed over me. I'd had nothing to worry about. Re-establishing the connection was as easy as picking up the reins of an old compliant mare. Controlling the monster was a bit like wrestling someone much smaller than I. It was pinned and wriggling to get free, but so outmatched by my strength that it posed little danger. But then the ease with which I controlled the Hollow was its own sort of problem. There was no simple way to get it out of the cage unless everyone believed it was dead and no longer a threat, and there was no way anyone would believe it was dead if my victory came too easily.
I was a scrawny, un-Ambro-enhanced kid. I couldn't just slap it and have it keel over. For this ruse to be properly convincing, I needed to put on a show. How was I going to kill it? Definitely not with my bare hands. Searching the cage for inspiration, my eyes fell upon the previous fighter's knife, which he'd dropped by the metal post. The hollow was sitting next to the post, which was a problem, so I picked up a handful of gravel, ran toward it suddenly, and threw it.
"Corner,"
I said, again covering my mouth. The hollow turned and darted into the corner, which made it seem as though the handful of rocks had startled it. Then I dashed to the post, snatched the knife from the ground, and retreated, a bit of bravery that earned me a whistle from someone in the crowd.
"Angry,"
I said, and the hollow roared and waved its tongues as if infuriated by my bold move. I glanced behind me to find Emma in the crowd, and I saw her moving furtively toward the man with the keys. Good. I needed to make things tough for myself.
"Come at me,"
I ordered, and once the hollow had lurched a few paces in my direction, I told it to lash out a tongue and grab me by the leg. It did, the tongue connecting with a sting and wrapping twice around my calf. Then I made the hollow pull me off my feet and drag me toward it through the dirt, while I pretended to grasp for a handhold. As I passed the metal post, I threw my arms around it.
"Pull up,"
I said.
"Not hard."
Though my words weren't very descriptive, the hollow seemed to understand exactly what I meant, as if just by picturing an action in my head and speaking a word or two aloud, I could convey a paragraph's worth of information. So when the hollow pulled upward as I clung to the post, raising my body into the air, it was precisely as I'd imagined it. "I'm getting good at this," I thought with some satisfaction. I struggled and groaned for a few seconds in what I hoped sounded like authentic pain, then released the post. The crowd, expecting that I was about to be killed in what was probably the shortest match yet, began to jeer and call me names. It was time for me to get in a hit.
"Leg,"
I said. The hollow again lashed a tongue around my leg.
"Pull."
It began to drag me toward it as I kicked and flailed.
"Mouth."
It opened its mouth as if to swallow me whole. I quickly turned my body and slashed at the tongue around my ankle. I hadn't really cut the hollow, but I told it to quickly let go and scream so that it would look like I had. The hollow complied, screeching, and then reeling its tongues back into its mouth. It felt like bad pantomime to me. There'd been a second of lag between my command and the hollow's response, but apparently the crowd bought it. The jeers turned to cheers for a match that was getting interesting, with an underdog who maybe had a fighting chance after all. In what I hoped didn't seem like a fight scene from a low-budget movie, the hollow and I squared off and traded a few blows. I ran at it, and it knocked me down. I slashed at it, and it backed off. It howled and waved its tongues in the air as we circled each other. I even had it pick me up with a tongue and gently shake me until I pretended to stab the tongue, and it, probably too gently, dropped me again. I risked another glance at Emma. She was standing in the middle of the group of fighters near the man with the keys. She made a line across the throat gesture at me.
"Quit messing around."
Right. Time to end this. I took a deep breath, gathered my courage, and went for the big finish. I ran at the hollow with my knife raised. It swung a tongue at my legs, which I jumped over, then another at my head, which I ducked. All as planned. What was supposed to happen next was that I would jump over another tongue at my feet, then pretend to stab the hollow in the heart.
But instead, the tongue hit me directly in the chest. It connected with the force of a heavyweight boxer, flinging me onto my back and knocking the wind out of me. I lay there stunned, unable to breathe as the crowd booed.
"Back!"
I tried to say, but I didn't have the breath. And then it was on top of me, jaws wide and bellowing with anger. The hollow had thrown off my yoke, if only for a moment, and it was not happy. I had to regain control, and fast, but its tongues had pinned my arms and one leg, and its arsenal of gleaming teeth was closing in on my face. I was only just drawing breath, a gagging lungful of the hollow stink, and instead of speaking, I choked. That might have been the end of me, but for the strange anatomy of hollows. Fortunately, it couldn't close its jaws around my head with its tongues extended. It had to release my limbs before it could bite off my head, and the moment I felt its tongue release my arm, the arm with the hand that still held the knife, I did the only thing I could think of to preserve myself. I thrust the knife upward. The blade plunged deep into the hollow's throat. It screeched and rolled away, tongues flipping and grasping at the knife. The crowd went crazy with excitement. I was finally able to draw a full, clean breath, and I sat up to see the hollow writhing on the ground a few yards back, black blood spurting from its wounded neck. I realized, with none of the satisfaction I might have felt under different circumstances, that I had probably just killed the thing, really killed it, which was not even remotely the plan. From the corner of my eye, I saw Sharon shaking his open hands at me, the universal sign for, "You just ruined everything." I stood up, determined to salvage what I could. Re-exerting my control over the hollow, I told it to relax, that it felt no pain. Gradually, it quit struggling, its tongues sinking toward the ground. Then I walked over to it, pulled my bloody knife from its neck, and held it up to show the crowd. They screamed and cheered, and I did my best to look triumphant, when really I felt like a giant failure. I was deathly afraid I'd just botched our friend's rescue. The man with the keys opened the cage door, and two men ran over to check the hollow.
"Don't move,"
I murmured as they examined it, one of them aiming a shotgun at its head while the other poked it with a stick and then held a hand below its nostrils.
"Don't breathe either."
It didn't. In fact, the hollow did such a great job pretending to be dead that I, too, would have been convinced if not for the ongoing connection between us. The men bought it. The examiner tossed away his stick, held up my arm like the victor in a boxing match, and declared me the winner. The crowd cheered again, and I could see money changing hands, the disappointed people who'd bet against me grumbling as they shelled out bills. Soon spectators were entering the cage to get a better look at the supposedly dead hollow, Emma and Sharon among them. Emma threw her arms around me.
"It's okay," she said. "You had no choice."
"It's not dead,"
I whispered to her.
"But it's hurt. I don't know how long it has. We've got to get it out of here."
"Then it's a good thing I managed to get these," she said, slipping a ring of keys into my pocket.
"Ha!" I said. "You're a genius."
But when I turned to unlock the hollow's chain, I found myself blocked by a swarm of people all clamoring to get close to it. Everyone wanted to get a good look at the thing, to touch it, to take a wisp of its hair or a clod of blood-soaked dirt as a memento. I started to shove my way through, but people kept stopping me to shake my hand and slap me on the back.
"That was unbelievable! You got lucky, kid. You sure you didn't take Ambro?"
All the while I was chanting under my breath for the hollow to stay down and stay dead, because I could feel it beginning to squirm, like a little kid who'd sat still for too long. It was antsy and hurt, and it required every spare ounce of my concentration to keep it from leaping up and filling its jaws with all the tempting, peculiar flesh that surrounded it. I'd finally reached the hollow's chain and was looking for the padlock when the Ambro dealer accosted me. I turned to see his creepy bearded mask just inches from my face.
"You think I don't know what you're doing?" he said.
He was flanked by his two armed guards.
"You think I'm blind?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said. For a queasy second, I thought he was on to me and knew the hollow wasn't really dead, but his men weren't even looking at it. He grabbed me by my jacket collar.
"No one hustles me," he said. "This is my place."
People were starting to back away. This guy clearly had a bad reputation.
"No one's hustling anyone," I heard Sharon say behind me. "Just calm down."
"You can't trick a trickster," the dealer said. "You come in here claiming he's fresh meat, never fought so much as a grim cub before, and then this?"
He swept his arm toward the fallen hollow.
"Not in a million years!"
"He's dead," I said. "Check for yourself if you want to." The dealer let go of my jacket and put his hands around my throat instead.
"Hey!"
I heard Emma say. The guards pointed their guns at her.
"My only question," said the dealer, "is what are you selling?"
He began to squeeze.
"Selling?"
I croaked. He sighed, irritated at being forced to explain.
"You come into my place, kill my hollow, and convince my customers they don't need to buy my product?"
He thought I was a rival drug dealer, there to steal his business. Madness. He squeezed harder.
"Let the boy go," Sharon pleaded.
"If you're not on Ambro, then what is it? What are you selling?"
I tried to respond, but couldn't. I looked down at his hands. He took my hint and loosened his grip, slightly.
"Speak,"
he said magnanimously. What I said next probably sounded to him like a choked cough.
"The one on the left,"
I said in hollow speak. And then the hollow sat up stiff and straight like Frankenstein's monster come to life, and the few peculiars still nearby screamed and ran. The dealer turned to look, and I punched him in the mask. The guards didn't know who to shoot first, me or the hollow. That split second of indecision was their undoing. In the time it took for them to turn their heads, the hollow had flung all three of its tongues at the closest guard. One disarmed him, while the remaining two grabbed him by the waist, picked him up, and used him like a battering ram to knock down the other. Then it was just the dealer and me. It seemed to dawn on him that I was the one controlling the hollow. He dropped to his knees and began to beg.
"This might be your place," I said to him, "but that's my hollow."
I made it wrap a tongue around the dealer's neck. I told him we would be leaving with the hollow ghast, and the only way he would survive is if we were allowed to go in peace.
"Yes, yes,"
he agreed, his voice shaking.
"Yes, of course."
I unlocked the padlock and unchained the hollow. With the crowd looking on, Emma, Sharon, and I led the limping hollow toward the open cage door, the dealer in front of us saying,
"Don't shoot! No one shoot!"
as best he could with a hollow ghast's tongue collared around his neck. We locked the cage behind us, with most of the spectators still inside, then walked out through the Ambro den, back the way we'd come, and on to the street. I was tempted to make a pit stop to destroy the dealer's Ambro supply, but decided it wasn't worth the risk. Let them choke on it. Besides, maybe it was better not to waste the stuff, if there was even a tiny chance that those stolen souls could one day be reunited with their owners. We left the dealer on his hands and knees in the gutter, gasping for air, his mask dangling from one ear. We were about to put the whole filthy scene behind us when I heard a tiny growl and remembered the Grim Cubs. I looked back at them, torn. They were at the end of their chains, straining to come with us.
"We can't," Sharon said, urging me on.
I might have left them if Emma hadn't caught my eye.
"Do it," she mouthed.
"It'll just take a second," I said. It took 15, in the end, to make the hollow uproot the post the cubs were chained to, and by then a gang of angry addicts had gathered outside the Ambro den. It seemed worth it, though, when we left with those cubs trailing after, chains and post dragging behind them, slow and encumbered until my hollow, in a gesture all its own, scooped them into its arms and whisked them along. It quickly became obvious that we had a problem. We'd walked only a few blocks, but already people on the street had noticed the hollow. To anyone but me, it was just a half-visible collection of paint splotches, but it still attracted attention, and because we didn't want anyone to see where we were going, we had to figure out a subtler way to get back to Bentham's. We ducked into a back street. The moment I stopped forcing it to walk, the hollow sank into an exhausted squat. It looked so frail there on the ground, bleeding, its body curled into itself, tongues tucked away in its mouth. Sensing its distress, the cubs it had rescued snuffled against it with their wet, wiggling snouts, and the hollow reacted with a quiet snarl that seemed almost tender. I couldn't help feeling a pulse of affection for all three, estranged siblings of a sort.
"I hate to say it, but that's almost cute," Emma said.
Sharon snorted.
"Dress it up in a pink tutu if you like. It's still a killing machine."
We brainstormed ways to get it to Bentham's without it dying en route.
"I could close that wound in its neck," Emma said, offering a hand that was just starting to glow.
"Too risky," I said. "The pain could snap it out of my control."
"Bentham's healer might be able to help it," Sharon said. "We'll just have to get to her quickly."
My first thought was to run across the rooftops. If only the hollow had the strength, it could have carried us up the side of a building and bounded to Bentham's out of sight. But right now, I wasn't even sure walking was an option. Instead, I suggested we wash off the hollow's white paint so that no one could see it but me.
"Absolutely not. No way. No, sir," said Sharon,
shaking his head vigorously.
"I don't trust that thing. I want to keep an eye on it."
"I've got it under control," I said, slightly offended.
"So far," Sharon shot back.
"I agree with Sharon," said Emma. "You're doing marvelously, but what happens when you're in another room, or fall asleep?"
"Why would I leave the room?"
"To relieve yourself," said Sharon. "Are you planning on taking your pet Hologast into the water closet?"
I said. "I guess I'll cross that bridge when I come to it."
"The paint stays on," said Sharon.
"Fine," I said irritably. "So, what do we do?" A door banged open down the alley, and a cloud of steam came billowing out. A man emerged pushing a wheeled cart, which he parked in the alley before going back inside. I ran to take a look. The door belonged to a laundry, and the cart was filled with dirty linens. It was just large enough to fit a small person or a curled-up hollow ghast. I'll admit it. I stole the cart. I wheeled it back to the others, emptied it, and made the hollow climb in. Then we piled the dirty laundry on top, lifted the bear cubs in, and wheeled the whole thing down the street. No one gave us a second look. Chapter 6. When we reached the house, it was nearly dark. Nim rushed us into the entrance hall, where Bentham waited anxiously. He didn't even bother to greet us.
"Why have you brought these Grimms?" he said, his eyes darting to the laundry cart. "Where's the creature?"
"It's here," I said. Lifting out the cubs, I began to pull back the linens. Bentham looked, but kept his distance. The sheets on top were white, but grew bloodier as I dug, becoming a black cocoon as I reached the bottom. I pulled back the last, and there it was, a small withered thing in a fetal curl. It was hard to believe this pathetic creature was the same one that had given me such nightmares. Bentham stepped closer.
"My God," he said, looking at the bloody sheets. "What did they do to him?"
"Actually, I did that," I said. "I didn't really have a choice." "It was about to swallow Jacob's head," Emma explained.
"You didn't kill it, did you?" Bentham said. "It's no use to us dead."
I said, "I don't think so," and then told the hollow to open its eyes, and very slowly it did. It was still alive, but weak. "I don't know how much longer it'll last, though."
"In that case, we've not a moment to waste," said Bentham. "We must send for my healer right away and hope to heaven her dust works on hollows."
Nim was sent running to fetch the healer. While we waited, Bentham led us into his kitchen and offered us biscuits and canned fruit. Either because of nerves or all the squeamish things we'd seen, neither Emma nor I had an appetite. We picked at the food out of politeness while Bentham filled us in on what had happened while we were gone. He'd made all necessary preparations to his machine, he said, and everything was ready. All he needed was to plug in the hollow ghast.
"Are you sure it'll work?" Emma said.
"Sure as I can be, without ever having tried it," he replied.
"Will it hurt him?" I asked, feeling oddly protective of the hollow, if only because I'd gone to such trouble to rescue it.
"Of course not," Bentham said with a dismissive wave.
The healer arrived, and upon seeing her I nearly shouted in surprise, not because she was so unusual-looking, though she was, but because I was absolutely certain I had seen her before, though I couldn't say where or how I'd managed to forget an encounter with someone so strange. Her only visible body parts were her left eye and left hand. The rest was hidden beneath acres of fabric, shawls, scarves, a dress, and a bell-shaped hoop skirt. She seemed to be missing her right hand, and the left was in the grip of a young man with brown skin and wide, bright eyes. He wore a jaunty silk shirt and a wide-brimmed hat, and he was leading the healer as if she were blind or otherwise disabled.
"I'm Reynaldo," said the young man in a crisp French accent, "and this is Mother Dust. I speak for her."
Mother Dust leaned toward Reynaldo and whispered something in his ear. Reynaldo looked at me and said,
"She hopes you are feeling better."
That's when I realized where I'd seen her. In my dreams, or what I thought had been dreams,
while recovering from my attack.
Yes, much better, I said, unnerved.
Bentham skipped the formalities.
Can you heal one of these? He said,
leading Reynaldo and Mother Dust to the laundry cart.